Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 18th, 2016, and this is show number 593. Well, this week I took delivery of an iPhone 7 Plus and the Apple Watch Series 2 Aluminium. I got to tell you, I've got some thoughts on the first few days with the iPhone 7 Plus, but I haven't had time to write up my experiences with the camera yet. I've taken a bunch of comparison photos between the 7 Plus and the 6, but I want to do a good job of analysis before talking about it. The same is true with the Series 2 watch. It's killing me, though. I really, really want to talk about them, but I don't want to do a bad job as much as I want to be, first. Anyway, I'm not first anyway. Other people are talking about it, but you know what I mean. I do want to tell you one great anecdote, though. I finished off my first thoughts blog post about the iPhone 7 Plus, and I ran out the door with Tesla for a quick walk to the grocery store. On my way, I got a Telegram message on my watch from Mark Pauly. He said he'd found two typos in the blog post. You know how I like to be notified of that, so that was a good thing. When I got to the store, I quickly grabbed the three things I needed and I got in line. With only two people ahead of me in the express lane, I didn't have much time, but I whipped out my giant screen iPhone, logged into WordPress and Safari on podfeet.com, made the edits, hit save. Right then, the guy was ready for me to pay. I double-tapped the side button on the Apple Watch, turned my wrist over, boom, paid with Apple Pay. I live in the future. It was awesome. I really, really had fun with that. So it really does work sometimes. Well, in this week's Chit Chat Across the Pond, Bart Bouchatz takes us through Programming by Stealth, installment 21, where we get into jQuery basics. This is another really easy lesson where he reviews some stuff we learned way back when about HTML and CSS, and then shows us how to use jQuery to search for elements on a web page. He shows us how to limit the search and filter the results. Then he shows us how to actually start changing the CSS with jQuery. It's such a fun lesson. I hope you go check it out over at podfeet.com. Sunday night during the live show, we noticed a big problem with the page for the live show, podfeet.com/live. It wasn't showing all of the elements of the page. At the top, when it's working properly, you should see a clock that tells you what time it is at my house. It's not that I'm a narcissist. It's there because I do the live show at 5 p.m. where I am. So if you go to the page and it's not live when you think it should be, you can look at the clock in your time zone and it'll tell you whether it's 5 o'clock where I live. Also not showing was the live video from YouTube, which is essentially the whole point of the live show. I was alerted to the missing elements first by Steve, but I assumed it was a problem on his computer. But then the live chat room confirmed that both the clock and the video were missing. I figured out what the problem was fairly quickly. Bart and I had worked just a few weeks back to get podfeet.com set up as a secure website, buying a certificate and enabling it through my web host. Right before the live show, I edited the .htaccess page for my web server to give it a permanent 301 redirect. That tells that all of the websites in the world, anybody who links to me, anytime somebody requests HTTP, it's routed over to HTTPS. By doing a permanent redirect, that means any service like iTunes, for example, would look at it and say, oh, let me permanently change that so it wouldn't have to keep getting that redirect. Well, the reason that affected the live show page is because the two elements in question, the clock and the live video, are both embedded HTTP links. In the old days, a browser would put a giant pop-up on screen to tell you that there were insecure elements on the page. But people just always said yes and went on their merry way. Instead, now browsers simply block insecure content on secure pages. Makes a bit more sense, right? Now, of course, there's nothing on podfeet.com that really requires security because you're never putting in your bank account information or anything like that on my website. In fact, other than writing text comments, you're not entering any content at all. However, it is a bit alarming, say in Chrome, when you notice the red X in the URL bar saying, danger, insecure content. The good news is that the video is pretty easy to fix. Every week, Steve copies the embed link from the Hangout on Air into the live show page at podfeet.com/live, if I haven't mentioned it enough times. So now he needs to remember to put an S on the end of the HTTP. And that's not a process fraught with danger at all, is it? I hope someone reads or hears this and remembers it for me, just in case Steve is out of town at some point and I have to do it. The clock is a bit more problematic, though, because adding the S doesn't fix it. Bart rubbed his hands together with delight when he saw this, though. He said he's been searching for the right project for us to do to program in Programming by Stealth, and he says this would be the perfect thing for us to build. I'm super excited. I have no clue how we'll even start, but I'm, of course, looking forward to it. I've been thinking about redesigning podfeet.com for a really long time. It was a cool theme when I built it about 126 years ago, but it's really kind of showing its age. I think we've kind of outgrown it with separate NoSilicast and Chit Chat Across the Pond shows, special series like Taming the Terminal and Programming by Stealth. We've got all the tutorials and, of course, links to cool stuff like our Facebook and Google Plus groups and ways to help the show. Personally, I think visually it's a hot mess. I don't know how anybody finds anything on there. So I've started working on a redesign, but I thought it might be a good idea to start getting some feedback first. I put up a very simple 5-question poll over on podfeed.com. I may ask more questions later, but I'm going to start out easy just to sucker you into giving your advice. I want to know what you do on the site, what you wish was easier, how you access it, like mobile or through a computer, which podcasts you listen to, and what you'd like to see improved. I pushed it out earlier in the week on social media, and as is usually the case with these things, it has turned out to be the comments that seem to matter the most when I'm reading them. The statistics are good because they're telling me kind of like what I should make sure is prioritized on the front page. So if you care a lot about what happens on podfeet.com, you should go over and take a look at that survey and give me your feedback. So I hope you go over and participate in the poll, and I did make sure it was the kind where you can see the results after you participate, which I think is way more fun. I hate it when I do a poll and it just goes, thank you. It's like, well, I want to see everybody's voting. That's the fun part. So anyway, stay tuned. I think things are going to get a lot more usable soon. Well, I entitled the next segment, Activity Tracking is Really Improved with watchOS 3 and iOS 10, but I'll leave it up to you whether all of these are improvements to you. One of the reasons that Fitbit has been so successful has been because of the ability to share your activity with your friends. Peer pressure or encouragement, whichever works for you, you get it from sharing exercise with your friends. When I left Fitbit for the Apple Watch, I really missed smack talking with my friends on Fitbit. Now with iOS 10 and watchOS 3, activity sharing has come to the Apple Watch. On the iPhone in the Activity app, you can tap on the sharing button on the bottom. Next, you'll see a plus button in the upper right where you can add friends. It's going to ask your permission to start sharing your data with your friends. Now, it only lists those in your contacts who have an Apple Watch who have agreed to do the activity sharing. If you try to add someone who has an iPhone but no Apple Watch, it'll tell you that you cannot share activity with them because they don't have an Apple Watch. That seems kind of short-sighted to me since many people track their activity with a phone. Maybe they'll fix that later. Anyway, sharing with someone causes several things. The coolest part is that in the sharing tab in the Activity app, you can see their active calories burned against their goals. The list isn't sorted by the most calories burned, it's by the percentage of each person's goal. I think that's actually a better way to do it. Otherwise, you know, I'd have no friends at all. But it's good because it's like looking at your own PR, you know, your own personal record. It's what's good for you. So it makes it a little more fun to share that way, I think, than if it was just top number of calories. You can change the sort from the default of active calories to by name, exercise, steps, or workout. Sharing even shows on the Apple Watch itself. If you tap on the Activity app on the watch, the default is to show you your own activity. But if you swipe to the left, you can actually see your friend's activity right there on your watch. If you press and hold, you can change the sort order there as well. You can tap on each person's name in your sharing list and see a full list of their exercise, stand, steps, distance, and workouts. I just hear people like Dorothy saying to themselves, well, that's just creepy. To that I say, one woman's creepy is another woman's awesome. There's another thing that comes along with sharing, and that's notifications. So let's say you're friends with me in sharing. I go to the beach and I start a workout of a third of a mile walk from the car to the beach. You see, we're cheap and we don't like to pay for the close parking when we're going down there to exercise anyway, so we walk a third of a mile. I finish that workout. I start a new one for my speed walk. That's another 3.63 miles to go up and back on the beach strand in 46 minutes. I stop that workout and I start another one to walk the third of a mile back to the car. I finish that workout and then about 4 in the afternoon I take Tessa out for a walk, never less than a half an hour and often a full hour. That means in a single day, you're going to get 4 notifications from me on your Apple Watch. Well, here's the good news. In the sharing part of the activity on the iPhone, when you look at the details of someone's activity, if you scroll down, you can see an option to mute just that person's notifications. Earlier this week, when I got back from a 10-mile bike ride after 3 walking workouts this afternoon, Stephen Getz, Alistair Jenks, and Mark Pauly were all giving me a hard time about how many notifications they got. How long do you think it's going to be before they're going to mute me? I give them 2 days, tops. Well, if you have a friend that's giving a hard time about your activity level, maybe not being encouraging, you can actually choose to hide your activity from just that friend. And of course, there's also a button to remove that friend. I think Apple made some good choices when they gave us this granular level of control over our sharing preferences by person. The Apple Watch interface for workouts has been an adventure over time in swiping and tapping and swiping and long pressing and tapping yet again. Early on, it was really hard to remember what to do and even figure out what to do with it. And after the muscle memory kicked in, the Apple Watch seemed to become less responsive to my presses and taps and swipes. Steve said he was experiencing pretty much the same thing. Now, with watchOS 3, the entire interface has changed. Let me start with the best change. On watchOS 2, to finish a workout, you had to long press and hold, which would trigger a new screen with pause and stop as options. It would usually take 2 to 3 times to get this to work. With watchOS 3, you simply swipe from left to right, and there's the stop pause screen. One of the reasons they can do this is that they got rid of a whole lot of other swiping. With the old interface, you were often swiping and tapping to change what you saw on screen during a workout. So let's say the workout app was showing you your pace and your elapsed time, but you wanted heart rate. You'd have to give up one of those to switch it to heart rate. There were so many options, it was a normal practice to spend 30 seconds fiddling with it to get it right. The good news is that you only have 2 screens now, the workout screen and the finish pause screen. At first, I thought that the bad news was that you're locked into whatever Apple decides you want to see on your type of workout, the type of workout that you've chosen to do. For example, when you do an outdoor cycle, by default, you'll see elapsed time, speed and distance per hour, heart rate, and total distance. But if you run, the speed is replaced with pace, as in minutes and seconds for a mile or a kilometer. But if you walk, the pace is replaced with active calories. I was kind of bummed about that because on my speed walks, when I'm really pushing myself, I need to see that pace to see if I can break my personal record. So I don't have access to that when I'm walking. By the way, since you asked, that personal record was a 12-minute mile, also known as walking 5 miles per hour. In the last year since I started walking instead of running because of my stupid toe, I have never been passed by another walker, but I have passed 3 runners. Anyway, while I wished I had that pace on my walks, I happened to mention to Bart that I was really annoyed by this. And he and Giles Croft also mentioned this on Twitter. They explained to me that you can change the information you see in your workouts. I thought you couldn't do it. They instructed me to open the Apple Watch app on the iPhone, scroll down to workout, tap on workout view. Now with multiple metrics selected at the top, you can see all of the workout options below. You can see them for outdoor walk, indoor run, whatever. Anyway, tap on the one you want to modify. You'll see the list of metrics in the default at the top and do not include down below. Tap the edit button and add or delete at will. You can even change the order up and down. So now I have 0 to complain about on the new activity tracking options in iOS 10 and watchOS 3. But before the new operating systems, when you were done with the workout, you could see your split times when you looked in the activity app on iOS. Now with watchOS 3, they've added a feature to workouts. If you double tap the screen while you're working out, it registers what it calls a segment, and it puts a little number in a circle in the top left. So let's say you ride your bike 3 miles on flat ground, and then you're going to climb a huge hill for 2 miles, and then you get to go downhill all the way home. You could double tap at each major change and record them as segments. When you look at your activity on the iPhone after you get home, you'll be able to see your pace for each mile or kilometer if you're of that persuasion, and you'll also see separately your segment distances, elapsed time, and average paces. After all this coolness, there's one more thing I wanted to tell you about. The first time you launch a workout app on the Apple Watch and in watchOS 3, it will ask you if it's okay if it tracks your location during workouts. If you say yes, when you finish your workout and go into the activity app to look at it, at the very bottom of the details section below your split time and segment times, you'll see a route map. This is so cool. I'm afraid both Map My Walk and Map My Ride have been Sherlocked for me. I removed them from my phone. It's because that's the only thing I wanted out of those apps. I wanted to see my route. The route map on iOS 3 shows you your pace in green, yellow, and red segments along the path. Now, I'm not sure what they use to define those colors, though, because while my cycle the other day had a lot of green segments, my outdoor walk was yellow, orange, and a bit of red. I'd like to take that engineer and UI designer that worked on this feature, I'd like to take them on my outdoor walk and see if they think 5 mile per hour walks are only yellow. Anyway, I only have one real problem with the workout app on the new WatchOS 3. In order to make this review interesting and to help myself remember what the watch was doing, I needed to take screenshots. On WatchOS 2, you did this by holding down the two physical buttons at the same time. That didn't work on the new OS. Luckily, my daughter Lindsay is a geek too, and she told me that you had to turn that feature on because evidently people were taking screenshots accidentally with their watches. I think if you wear your watch up high, like really close to your hand, and you bend your wrist, it could take a screenshot accidentally. Anyway, she explained that all I had to do was open the Apple Watch app on the iPhone, go to My Watch, General, and scroll all the way to the bottom and then toggle the slider to enable screenshots. But that's not the problem I'm upset about with the workout app. The problem is that I found out the hard way that if you take a screen snapshot during a workout on the Apple Watch, it actually pauses the workout. I lost 10 precious minutes of my speed walk because of that. I hope you realize the sacrifices I make for you people. Overall, I think the updates to the activity features on the Apple Watch and the iPhone are fantastic. Mark Pauly in the live chat room asked a good question. He wanted me to explain that these changes that I just talked about, these have nothing to do with the new phone and the new watch. You get all of this with iOS 10 and WatchOS 3 as they were pushed out to the existing devices. So they really have done a really good job with these updates. I'm extremely impressed with the changes that they've made and how much better this works. I mean, it really, I think the watch is so much more useful now that they've come out with WatchOS 3. You know, I didn't go into podcasting to make money, but I also didn't go into to lose money either. I'd like to break even on it, maybe make enough money to buy more gadgets to review for you guys. To this end, I've decided to start using Patreon to give you guys an easy way to support the show. Patreon lets you pledge a weekly amount so that you only get billed if the podcaster actually produces a show. Well, in the case of my show, that's a guarantee since we haven't missed a show in over 10 years. If you head over to podfeet.com/Patreon, you give them your credit card and then choose how much you want to pledge to keep the show afloat. You can do a dollar or a quarter or $1,000 a show if you want, whatever you think it's worth. If you can't afford it, though, please do not donate. I'm serious about this. It's just if you think you could spare some money to help us out here, and, you know, that would really be great. I would like to give a shout out to our newest patrons this week. We've got Chad and I think it was WHK and Bob and Rob and Christopher and Tom. I can't thank all of you enough for helping the show like this. You guys are awesome. All right, let's get back to some geek fun. One of the hard things about reviewing gadgets is to remember to use the words for me and I feel and not make categorical judgments about these things. I hear a lot of male podcasters who talk about gadgets from their own point of view, but they don't take into account that another gender might have a different perspective. If I hear one more time, well, it has to fit in a pocket, I'm going to scream. You wouldn't think much of me as a reviewer if I said, if it fits in a purse, it's perfect, it's for everyone, right? Men are more likely to have pockets. Men are more likely to have big pockets. Women are more likely to have small or no pockets. And women are more likely to carry a purse. I make no value judgment on this. I'm just stating facts. With that in mind, I started thinking about going up in size from the iPhone 6 to the 7 Plus well before it was officially announced. My pants and shorts simply don't have pockets suitable for carrying any size of phone, but I do always carry my purse. Now, I carry a really tiny little purse, but there isn't a mobile phone made today that wouldn't fit in it. Even those waffle-sized phones are still thin, and they fit in anything bigger than the very smallest clutch. So maybe a plus-sized iPhone would be right for me. See what I did there? For me. When the iPhone Plus was finally announced with those dual camera lenses, I was sold beyond any doubt that I wanted to go up. Now, it's going to kill me, but I'm going to save these camera discussions for another time and focus on the other features first. But the dual cameras were definitely important in helping me be sure I wanted to go for the Plus. Now that I have it in my hot little hands, I have to say that it took me no time at all to get used to the giant size of the 7 Plus. I immediately loved it. It doesn't feel huge to me at all. It feels just right. Now, since I'm 58 years old, even with progressive lenses, a bigger display is almost always better for me. With the plus-sized iPhone, I get the same number of icons on the home screen. They're just bigger and easier to see. But in other applications, you can actually get more on screen. Since many apps allow us to control the font size to our own desires, wish they all did. Anyway, you can make the phone go either way for you and your eyes. If you've got great eyes, man, you shrink that stuff down, get a lot on screen, but I don't have to do it. One thing I was looking forward to was being able to zoom things up bigger in web pages, and the 7 Plus does not disappoint in that. I'm a big fan of AppleCare Plus for the iPhones, especially because my family is prone to dropping their phones. In past years, even with AppleCare, the screen replacement was $79 for the smaller phone and $99 for the Plus. Well, Apple just recently changed their offering. It's now only $29 to replace a cracked screen under AppleCare Plus. Regardless of the size of the phone, it doesn't matter. It's always $29. This makes me wonder, maybe they're less likely to crack. Why would Apple reduce that price so much unless it is because they're less likely to crack? Wouldn't that be lovely if that's true? I'm making that up, by the way, but I just think it's a possibility. So this not only makes AppleCare Plus a more compelling offering, I started thinking maybe I don't have to protect my phone like an armored vehicle. For the first few days, I've been using the phone in its naked form, and it's a joy to hold. That is, until I try to type with both thumbs. The phone feels top-heavy like that, and since it's slippery, it's kind of hard to use that way for typing. Since I'm not that great of a two-thumb typist anyway, I tried holding it in one hand and typing with my forefinger, and that worked really well for me. Pat Negler picked me up a pretty cool case from Tech 21 that I might end up using, though. It has a nice rubber bumper that feels pretty good, and the back is a clear plastic with a kind of golf ball-like indented back that shows off the lovely gold of my new phone. It's called the Evo Mesh, and she found it at Apple for $40. It looks great, but the jury is still out on whether I'm going to use it or not. I'd love to have the nerve to keep going with a naked phone, but I'm not sure. I may flinch. As you've probably heard, Apple took out the physical home button and replaced it with a haptic feedback button provided by their proprietary Taptic engine. Now, I'm a huge fan of the Magic Trackpad Apple introduced about a year ago in the MacBook and the standalone trackpad with the same technology. So I was really looking forward to this new home button on the iPhone. That physical home button was problematic for a lot of people. A lot of people had to have it replaced as it becomes non-responsive over time. As a mechanical engineer, it pains me to point out that the fewer moving parts you have, the fewer failures you're going to have from repeated usage. When you first start using the phone with the this haptic feedback, you're given a little screen where you can choose how hard you have to press to engage the home button. Personally, I hate clicking hard on things. On the old MacBooks and MacBook Pros without this kind of fake touch, I always immediately turned on the ability to tap instead of click on the trackpad. But with the Taptic engine, I find myself very pleased with the light click of the Magic Trackpad. On the iPhone 7 Plus, I found that the lightest touch to the Taptic home button is the most pleasing to me. It seems that lately Apple is all about customization now, so you get to pick what feels right for you. Unless you want a headphone jack, of course, but let's not go down that road, okay? With the non-mechanical home button come some weird changes. I wanted to do a hard reboot on my phone, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. On older phones, you hold down the power button and the home button at the same time, and you get a power down slider. When I tried that on the iPhone 7 Plus, it kept taking screenshots instead. Normally, a single click of these two buttons does a screen snapshot, but for the life of me, I couldn't get it to shut down no matter how long I held it. It just kept taking screenshots. I eventually discovered an article on the Mac Observer where Jeff Gammack credited Victor Cahiao for figuring out how to reboot these phones. With the new home button, full power down is the power button plus the down volume button. I never would have thought of that on my own. By the way, I never get a slider either. It just kind of turns gray, flickers, and disappears. I don't think that's on purpose. I think there's something a little glitchy there. Well, I mentioned accidentally taking screenshots when I was trying to do that, but at the same time, I'm finding it harder to take them on purpose. It messed up so many times during a FaceTime call with Lindsay, where she was letting me talk to our grandson Forbes, that she mocked my technical skills. Man, daughters really know how to hit their mothers in their soft spots, don't they? That was terrible. Well, the speed of the 7 Plus is amazing. I put my iPhone 6 and 7 Plus side by side, and I launched a bunch of applications and moved around in them, and in every single case, the 7 was way, way, way faster. I mean, countable seconds faster. But then I had a thought. I borrowed Steve's iPhone, which is a 6S, and the 7 and 6S performed almost exactly the same. And some apps, they launched faster on the 7, but in some, the 6S was faster. In every case, though, it was differences of less than a second. Now, it's important to note that my 6 and 7 Plus were both running iOS 10.0.1, and the 7 Plus was restored from a backup of the 6, so they should have been the same. It is entirely possible, though, that some sort of cruft got left out when the restore from backup took place, and that's why the 7 Plus is so darn much faster. As of the time I'm telling you this, I'm doing a full reset of the iPhone 6, and I'm restoring it from the iCloud backup of the iPhone 7. I'm going to rerun my tests, and I'll be sure to let you know what I find. If I find that the 6 got a lot faster, that's a little hint. If you think your iPhone's getting slow, back it up and restore it back from its own backup. Although the 7 Plus costs a grip, as the SMR podcast guys would say, I have no regrets. The price was $869 for the 128GB AT&T model, unlocked. That's before tax and AppleCare. But as always, remember with Apple products that they retain an amazing amount of resale value. As soon as I'm done with my tests, I'll be delivering this pristine phone in its original box to a happy friend of mine for the price of $300. I could have gotten a little bit more, maybe $360, $370 is what they're selling for on eBay right now, but I find that procrastinating on selling is a road to never selling at all. Compare this to the $200 that Gazelle is offering for this phone in flawless condition, and that $300 doesn't sound so bad. It also does a great deal for my friend, as Gazelle sells the same phone for $400. I brokered this deal through my friend Diane, and I demanded that she cook me something grown on her farm, like maybe that amazing zucchini bread she makes. Now how good of a deal do you think I got? Well, I'll get back to you on the iPhone 6 comparison tests after the reset from backups is complete. In any case, if you're a girl with a purse, or a guy with big dad pockets, or secure enough in your masculinity to carry a purse like my brother does, then I can highly recommend you get the iPhone 7 Plus. And that's before I even tell you how wicked awesome the dual cameras are. Spoiler alert. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchatz. We have some big stuff this week, don't we, Bart?
Plenty to talk about as usual, yeah. Slightly fewer in number, but plenty to talk about all the same. I was happy on Thursday when I looked at my RSS client and it said 32 stories. And I was like, oh, that's less than 50. I like this. But some of them are big, so yeah.
Well, we got meat to chew on, right?
We do indeed. So I'm going to start with the security medium because it this is a story that's been bubbling away for a few months, actually, but it didn't really make it into the mainstream until about a week or so ago. And it basically got picked up by a few high sort of, you know, popular in the techosphere blogs. And from there, it sort of went viral.
And I know Steve and about 48 other people asked you to talk about it, right?
Yes, indeedy. I was inundated with people saying, oh, my God, Dropbox, 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 Dropbox. So I spent some time reading it. And my initial reaction was quite negative. But then I saw the response from Dropbox's engineers. And now I'm more inclined of, well, you probably should have been clearer up front about this. But OK, I get what you're doing.
Oh,
but anyway, we'll arrive there. We'll take the scenic route and we'll arrive there.
Good.
So the story started a few months ago when a Mac blogger was poking around on his Mac and he discovered something unexpected in his system preferences. So for a little bit of backstory, OS X has over the last, I guess since the invention of iOS, been slowly locking things down. Now, not in a negative way, but in a, you can still get the permissions you need, but you got to ask for them kind of way. So one
for
of those
protection.
Things. That, yes, absolutely. So by default, apps are prevented from interacting with other apps' data and the OS in certain ways. But there are legitimate reasons why an app may need more privilege. And
like TextExpander, for example.
TextExpander is an example, exactly. So a particular class of app that really needs this kind of global access is apps for accessibility. And this is why you'll find the apps with this superpower you go to your control panel, you go to security and privacy, you go to the privacy tab, and then you'll have a bunch of different categories down the side. So location services is an obvious category, but another category is accessibility. And in there, you'll find Text Expander. And the reason is because Text Expander uses accessibility APIs designed for helping people type to help you type.
Right.
And so you will also find in there Dropbox, which is a bit weird. And that sort of made the Mac blogger go, "What? Huh? How'd you get there?" Because normally the only way you end up in there is by popping up a dialogue and saying, "Okay, I grant you that permission." And Dropbox aren't doing it that way. Dropbox are, well, we'll get to what they're doing, I guess, a little bit later on. But basically, he didn't grant permission, and there it was. Well, that's a bit weird. Untick. Didn't think too much more about it. Came back the next day. The tick was back.
Ooh.
Hang on a minute here. Why is this tick back? I didn't give you permission once, and I certainly didn't give you permission twice. So what's going on here? This seems to be something very nasty going on. He found a way to make the permission actually go away. He had to do a little bit of hackery to make Dropbox unable to give itself back that permission. And at that point in time, he says that Dropbox continued to function perfectly. So that would lead you to believe a couple of things. It would lead you to believe that Dropbox are doing some sort of hackery. And if they're able to reassert their power, the question it raises is, are they saving my password somewhere? Which is what I have heard said that they are. I don't believe that, but I have heard it said, and initially I didn't have any reason to doubt that, but now I do. And the other thing is, one of the key principles in IT security is the concept of least privilege. You should take the least permissions you need in order to do what you need to do, because if your app gets compromised or there's a bug, then it has as little as possible power to do harm. And so if the app genuinely doesn't need this privilege, then it shouldn't take this privilege if it doesn't need it. And the implication is, if you remove it and the app continues to function, well, why does it have this privilege in the first place?
Right.
So at that point in the story, I was quite concerned. And I was like, I don't like this. So I think my very first instinct was, well, they should have asked. And so I was a bit cranky. And then my instinct was, how are they reaffirming it? Maybe they have our passwords. And I was very cranky. But thankfully, Dropbox had the common sense to send an engineer out to answer these questions. And the advantage of sending an engineer out to answer these questions is engineers can be technical.
And they're not very good at subterfuge.
No, which is also
nuance isn't what engineers are good at.
So while it is still true to say that they are doing something I don't think is appropriate in one exact specific sense. So when you run the Dropbox installer, it uses OS X's standard mechanisms for gaining admin privileges, which is it asks the OS to ask you for your password. And if the OS is happy that you gave your password, the OS then gives the app privileges. The key point here is that the OS manages your password, not the app.
Okay.
But the app is granted root access.
Okay.
So the app is at that point in time super user on your computer, and it can install stuff at its leisure. That's the point of an installer.
All right.
Now, Dropbox is using that privilege to give itself that checkbox, and it doesn't ask you if that's okay. And I would say that's not okay. I don't think it's okay to use. So Dropbox says, I want your administrator access so I can install myself, but it doesn't say, and as part of that, I will enable accessibility access.
Why does it hurt to have it enable accessibility access?
Well, it's giving the app a very large amount of power. The app can then listen to every keystroke. I mean, Text Expander is listening to every single thing you type. So Dropbox has the ability to listen to every single keystroke entered on the computer.
So I have a lot of things in there, like Chrome.
Oh,
Chrome. Why does Google Chrome need that? Google Software Update, Google Talk plugin. I've got a couple of things that...
Are they under accessibility?
Yes. Security and privacy, accessibility. I've got a couple of apps that eject disk drives, like Mountain and one called Deeper, I think, also does that.
Oh, does it have a tick box next to it, or does it only come up in the list?
It has a tick box next to it. Google Chrome.
Okay, because Google Software Update is here without a tick box, as is Steam.
Sorry, Google Software Update does not have a tick mark next to it, but Google Chrome does. So Google Chrome is listening to every single keystroke? I guess.
No, it could be.
Could be.
Doesn't mean it is, right? If you have the power to add an event listener to the keyboard, it doesn't mean that you have added an event listener to the keyboard. Right? The accessibility isn't just about the keyboard. It's about, I'm not sure of everything it does, but it allows you to do things like to see the whole screen. So basically, anything you imagine that might be helpful to help an impaired person use their computer is controlled through accessibility access. So it might be being allowed to see the whole screen. And maybe Google Chrome needs that to do screen sharing.
Interesting. Safari is there, but not checked.
No, Safari's not here at all. Safari is there for me under location services, but not.
Snappeal from one of the photo apps is in here, but unchecked. I mean,
that's very unusual.
System preferences.
Okay, but if they're unchecked, I guess that's not that unusual.
Okay, Automator and Script Editor are both in here.
Checked or unchecked?
Checked.
That would imply that you did that. You wrote some sort of Automator action that needed to see the screen.
You know what? I wonder if it's Dorothy did the wrote that mouse script for the blind.
Well, that sounds like the kind of thing accessibility might need, because you're not normally able to control.
Okay.
You're not normally able to control the mouse in other apps.
Okay. All right. Okay. Good. I just wanted. And by the way, an event listener is again.
Well, so the concept is that the operating system provides APIs that you can basically say to the OS, dear operating system, I would like you to tell me every time someone clicks the mouse. Or dear operating system, I would like you to tell me every time someone moves the mouse. Dear operating system, tell me every time someone types a key.
Okay.
So something like Text Expander, it says, dear operating system, let me know whenever someone types a key. And every time you type a key, it's looking in its list of all of your expansions to see if one of them has been met. And if one of them has been met, it says, dear operating system, inject 4 backspaces and then these letters. And then your little, star or whatever goes.
So can an event listener be talking to the camera, talking to the microphone? Is it just
there may
input
not be
devices?
Events, right? It doesn't just have to be events. So it could also be a case of, dear operating system, show me what's happening on the entire screen, not just on my little bit of the screen. So that's sort of not an event. You're not saying, tell me when something happens. You're saying, do this for me now.
But I'm saying, one of the accessibility things would be that you can't type, so you use the voice control. Would you have an event listener for something like voice?
You might do. If you had something, if you had an app that listened for a magic word, that would need to be some sort of an event listener, wouldn't it? If there was some sort of magic word to trigger the app.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
I mean, there's all sorts of things. I mean, there's all sorts of things that come under this category.
So maybe I haven't let you finish the story yet, but at one point you said early on that that Dropbox was saving your password to Dropbox.
No, I said people were saying that Dropbox were saving your admin passwords to itself permissions.
No. We you and I chatted on chat earlier in the week, and you said that Dropbox was saving your Dropbox password in the clear on your Mac.
I tried to communicate. I tried to communicate was that at that point, I had been told by people I trust that Dropbox was saving your username, your user password, the password it uses to
your admin
that you log into your Mac with. It was saving it so that it could reestablish the permissions.
And that's not true.
I have found no evidence that it is, and the engineer's answer, and what I can see on my own Mac, tells me that they have a much simpler mechanism for doing it that doesn't involve any such shenanigans.
Okay.
So I don't believe it's true.
So is there anything scary about this?
Well, no. Okay, so I don't think there's anything untoward going on, apart from the fact that I would say that granting yourself accessibility access without asking the user first is inappropriate. It's not malicious. It's not evil. It's inappropriate. It's rude.
So they're back to tut-tut.
Yeah, you were back to tut-tut, actually, yes. So that criticism absolutely stands. Having said all that, so what Dropbox actually do, what their engineer says to do, and I have no evidence that the engineer is lying, and what he says makes perfect sense, and I can validate some of it with a terminal command. So when you install Dropbox, Dropbox asks Mac OS X to ask you for your admin password so that it can have root level access. And so the OS asks you for your password, you enter your password, the OS says, that really is your password. Okay, here you go, Mr. App, you may have root access. Mm-hmm. And that's a standard mechanism that installers use. It has the advantage, the installer never sees your password, the installer does get root access. So Dropbox used that root access to install helper apps as root.
Okay.
Which means that when these apps execute, they execute with root privileges. An app executes with the permission of its owner, or at least it can do if you use the terminal correctly. So what Dropbox do when they start up, when you start the Dropbox app, Dropbox runs the helper app that sets those permissions, and that app runs as root. So it hasn't saved your password. It's just while it had root powers, it's created a root level utility to set the permissions it wants.
And that's okay.
And it just triggers it. It's a perfectly legal and valid way of doing these things. And it's not a security risk in the sense that it's not that your password is in plain text somewhere. It doesn't need your password.
Okay.
Never needed your password.
All right.
And you can see these for yourself. So if you type into the terminal ls space minus l space slash library slash Dropbox helper tools, or library with uppercase L, Dropbox helper tools with uppercase D, uppercase H, and uppercase T, you'll see them. There will be an overall master helper tool, which is owned by Root and the group Wheel, which means it can execute as Root. And there'll be another helper app, which ends in a UID number, and there'll be one of those for every user on the Mac who uses Dropbox.
Yeah, I have three of them because I have three accounts that I move files between my accounts using Dropbox.
Yes, and you'll see that they end in 500 and then some low number, and that's on the Mac, user accounts are all 500 and something.
Okay.
So they're probably 501... 502, 503.
So this tells us what?
So this tells us that there is no earthly reason why Dropbox should want to save your password in order to reassert these permissions. So the theory that, well, they must have my password because they keep reasserting the permissions, that theory is not borne out by reality. They have a mechanism for doing so without any such chicanery. And I don't see any reason to believe there is such chicanery going on.
Okay. So what should they have done? Not ask for accessibility? There's no reason for it.
Okay, so they say that they need the accessibility access in order to do some of their badging of files, and they also need it to do some of their integrations with Office, and they say that they don't like the fact that they need it, so they're working with Apple to find more fine-grained APIs so that they can ask for less access in future.
No.
Now, that in particular, I very much approve of.
Yeah.
That is the right thing to do. So basically they say right now we're painting with a broad brush because we have no choice. We want to paint with a finer brush and we're working with Apple to achieve that. I'm so thinking, okay, that's reasonable.
How come unchecking it didn't mess it up? I guess because it reasserted itself.
It would have messed up the integration with Office and some of the badging. But would you necessarily notice that straight away? I mean, your files continue syncing.
Yeah. Okay.
So what it messes up is the edge features, not the core feature that is making my files go from A to B.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the notes that you put a link in the show notes to the Dropbox engineer chatting, and it says, and other integrations, finding Windows and other UI interactions.
It is a bit vague, but basically it means...
It says the Dropbox bag.
Some of the stupid stuff we hate. Like, you know, the way every time you plug in a camera, it says, hey, would you like to send all of your photos up to Dropbox? No, I certainly well wouldn't.
Yeah. Okay.
That's probably why they need as much access as they have, is because they're trying to upsell you into integrating as much of your digital life as possible into their service, which I can understand for financial reasons.
Okay.
As I say, it's still a tut-tut. But it's not, this is not catastrophic. This is not, well, I'm never using Dropbox again, or at least for me, it certainly isn't.
Okay, excellent.
Continuing to run it. That is the bottom line. It's on my Macs. It's staying there.
Good. All right.
Okay, so now we can do a normal security light.
Okay.
So first off, important security updates. Last Tuesday was Patch Tuesday. Microsoft and Adobe obliged. There are patches for critical vulnerabilities, including patches for Windows, IE, and Flash. So all of those things are big keystone products. So update, update, update.
Speaking of Flash, go to Forbes sometime on your iPad. There's a giant, really malformed, like, graphically horrible, you don't have Flash on this device banner.
Oh,
it is, it's well done. Appalling. Every time I hit it, I take a screenshot and I tweet it again.
Someday, someone in that organization will develop an iPad.
Yeah.
Now comes my standard reminder to people. iOS and watchOS, those new updates are not optional updates. Those updates are security updates. So if you're running iOS 9, you need to run iOS 10 now. It's not like the Mac where they keep doing updates to the last two. No, there is a current version of iOS, and you must be on that to be secure. iOS 10 is a security update, and there is a link in the show notes to prove it, to the security content of iOS 10, and a link below that to the security content of watchOS 3.
I did not know I assumed it was optional for a while. to know. Okay.
Apple have never given a patch to an old version of iOS. They do it for the Mac, but they don't do it for iOS.
I just didn't know and that 10 had security updates since they had come out with 9.3.5 about a minute and a half before iOS 10.
Yeah, but they didn't. I don't think that was their choice. I think that was foisted upon them.
Right.
And also, I know a lot of our listeners, well, us two anyway, are WordPress users. So just to mention that there was a critical fix to two patches in a critical patch to two critical vulnerabilities in WordPress that would allow attackers to take over your WordPress site.
Yeah.
So if you don't have your WordPress set up to auto update itself, you really, really should. And it definitely time you updated.
Okie dokie.
So important security news. Google have released fixes for two critical bugs in Android that can be described as being as serious as stage fright. In fact, one of them is spectacularly similar to stage fright. It's not in the same library, so it doesn't get the same cool name, but it is in code for processing JPEG images. In this case, it's in the code for processing EXIF information inside the JPEG images. So all you have to do to hack one of these devices is send someone a message with a JPEG with malicious data in the EXIF, and then you can hack root their device. Now, Google have released this patch for their devices, and it's been pushed into the great big cloud, where each manufacturer is then supposed to take those changes from Google, embed them into their own version of the operating system, hand that over to the carriers. The carriers are then supposed to make their customizations, and eventually it's supposed to make it out to the end users. But we all know that if your phone is a year or two old, the chances are you're never seeing this. And so here we are again, major catastrophic vulnerability, and the chances are millions of people are never going to see it.
Now, Samsung and another company, I forget what the other company, which company it was, have both committed to pushing these patches out.
For how? Okay, that's good. The more they push out, the better. Whether it'll make it down to two-year-old phones and stuff, I do not know.
Yeah, that remains, and it seems to me,
for everyone they do, right, is better.
I thought the what do you call the ISPs, the AT&Ts and Verizons of the world, I thought that they were also in the loop, though. So they Samsung could say, problem. I'm going to do it, but then Verizon says, yeah, let me test it for a while because we don't like support calls.
Well, there's two. It's not just tested. So there's two middlemen in the way. So Google write the canonical Android, and they hand that code to Samsung. And Samsung have Samsung Android, which has their own whiz-bangs. And so they then take the changes Google made and apply the change to their custom version of Android. And they then hand that custom version of Android to the carriers, who also have their own custom version of that Android, to add in all the carrier-specific tools. So they then have to copy and paste or integrate the changes that Samsung made into the changes in their version of Android, and that finally gets pushed out to the user. So it's not that the code Google writes has to go through two middlemen. It's that all the customizations have to be reapplied by the two middlemen. Hmm. So it's actually an awful lot of work. And so if you have a phone that's 2 years old and people aren't paying for it anymore, or, you know, it's paid off, you have no incentive to put the effort into fixing that phone.
Yeah.
Whereas with an Apple phone, the OS that comes from Apple is identical to what's running on your phone. Hmm. Which is why it's easy. It's just some bits to push around. But that's not the case with Android. It's a bad model, and it's going. They need to move to a more Apple-y model. The monthly updates is a good start. The fact that we talked a few weeks ago about Motorola refusing to commit is a bad start, but the fact that Samsung are committing is a good start again. So, progress, but I'm not sure it's sufficient. We shall see. Bad week for poor Google, actually, because actually bunched into the same story in our second one. Oh, by the by, some more malware got into the Google Play Store and got downloaded 2.5 million times.
Jeez. 2.5? Yes, was it on a lot of different apps?
Yes, it wasn't one app, but it was one piece of malware.
Hmm.
So, again, the standard advice is just because it's in an app store, you're safer in an app store than being in, like, sideloading something from a random website is just dangerous. The app store is like a city street. Probably okay, but don't be stupid.
Don't be on the dark alleys of the city street. One of the advices I heard, is that the right pronunciation?
Yeah, anyway,
we'll do it. One of the bits of advice I heard was that if there's an app that you wish existed on Android and it doesn't, don't download the one that pretends it is. So, like, let's say Instagram wasn't on Android. Don't get the Android app that's like, we figured it out. We made it. Because those, they said, tend to be dodgy. And that's interesting. Yeah.
Yep, and again, the standard stuff, a developer who's been around for years, regularly updates their apps, lots of reviews, they're not guarantees, but the more of those little tick boxes you can tick, the more confident you can be.
Yeah.
Now, security researchers have demonstrated a new attack that uses cheap USB dongles to extract login credentials from Windows PCs and at least some Macs. It's not quite clear how much it affects the Mac, even when they're physically locked. So this technique works because, well, okay, so to make this technique work, two things have to be true. So the first thing that is true, just a fact, is that you can now buy a USB stick that is about the size of a thumb drive that contains a full Linux PC. These things cost about $50, so they're not expensive. And you have a full computer the size of a USB thumb drive. It's magic. We live in a great age. It is also true that Windows machines and Macs, when you plug something into their USB port, if that something pretends to be a network adapter, like an Ethernet card or something, or a Wi-Fi dongle, if it pretends to be, so if it just spews out the right API calls to be such a thing, then the OS will install it even if the screen is locked. And that is, in my mind, an oversight. That is the actual problem. They shouldn't install stuff when the screen is locked. It makes perfect sense to auto-install a network card when when the screen is unlocked, because that means that you can take a dongle from your ISP, like a little MiFi thingy, and shove it in over USB and it'll just work. Or you can take an Ethernet dongle, shove it in, and start using your laptop on a corporate network or whatever. To have it just work is great, but it shouldn't just work while the screen is locked, because then anyone could come out to a locked computer and just make it go on the network. Now, once they've got it to go on the network, because they have a full Linux PC and the little thumb drive, they actually pretend in that little Linux PC, they do a whole network stack in pretend. So they say, yeah, I'm a network card. Oh, look, here's a DHCP server. It's just giving you an IP address. Yeah, go ahead there. Oh, look, and it's told you to do this, that, and the other. And basically they trick the computer into trying to make a connection over Samba to the pretend computer that doesn't exist on the pretend network that doesn't exist. And Samba uses terribly bad hashes of passwords, landman hashes they're called. And if you can get the computer to produce a landman hash, you can crack that very easily, very quickly, and get the username and password to log into the computer. And unfortunately, OS X supports connecting to Samba. But on OS X, you have to say, I want this username to be allowed to do that. So it actually tells you, warning, this will make you less secure. And if you go ahead and do it anyway, then the hash will be emitted by the Mac.
So I have, what is it called, ClamXAV set to scan thumb drives when they go in. If my computer is locked, will it do that first and stop it?
Okay, but so it's not connecting. It's not connecting your computer as a thumb drive. So it's not that a file system appears that some files are in that ClamXAV can scan. It connects as a network card, and it then tricks your computer into sending network traffic at the pretend network. So ClamXAV will have nothing to do here. The issue is that network cards get installed even when your screen is locked. The fix is very simple. Windows and Mac need to stop that happening.
Yeah.
Just very simple. If the screen is locked, don't do the install. If the screen is unlocked, do the install, because it's really convenient. In the meantime, what can we do as Security Light listeners? Don't leave your computer unattended in a public place, even if it's locked.
Wow.
And that's probably good advice anyway.
Right, because they get lifted.
Yeah,
but
you could be deprived of it.
You could be at work and a vendor comes in and it's not a laptop at all. It's a regular computer just sitting there and stick it in.
Yep. Very easy to do. It takes about 30 seconds to snag the hashes and then you can crack them at your leisure.
Yeah.
It's scary stuff. It's basically physical security. It's yet another example of why physical security continues to be paramount even in a digital age. You cannot stop worrying about physical security just because you have IT security. You need both. For something to be secure, it has to be physically secure and logically secure, if you get what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny. Steve and I were debating something last night about whether it really matters to put a piece of cardboard or tape over your webcam. And when I was talking to Tom Merritt, he said that he was mocked by Darren Kitchen for doing it, because Darren said, if you've got somebody controlling your webcam, you have other problems. But Steve made a good point. He said, would you rather have your machine hacked and naked pictures of you on the internet, or just your machine hacked? It was like, oh, okay,
right. Yeah. Just because you have other problems doesn't mean you want more.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I thought he made a good
way
point.
To put it.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much effort is it actually? I'm trying to remember. Some company was actually giving out a little sticker that you can put on your computer that just slides over and back. So it's very, very thin. It's two strips of plastic. One of them is a sticky back. Yeah. And so you stick it onto your computer next to the webcam and you slide it over and you slide it back. So basically you have a little physical shutter over your webcam.
Steve made me one out of black cardboard.
Well, there you go. This one is branded by someone. So basically it's a clever little thing to hand out as corporate swag.
Yeah.
So cool. An opportunity.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so that's the USB attack. It, you know, took a little bit of describing because it's a subtle attack, but there we go.
Yeah.
Google have announced that it will start to label some HTTP. It will start to label some HTTP websites as not secure. So that's a step above. Currently, they don't label it either way. So if you're a secure website, you get a sort of a you're secure. And an ordinary HTTP website gets a sort of a neutral branding. And an HTTPS website with an invalid cert gets an insecure branding. Well, now they're extending the actively this is not secure branding to some HTTP websites. And now this is a first step towards doing that for all HTTP websites in the future. But for the first step is basically if Chrome detects that you are entering usernames, passwords, or credit card numbers into an HTTP website, it will then actively brand the website as insecure. Have no doubt Google wants HTTP gone.
Yeah, yeah. So we haven't talked about it much on the show, but we insured, is the way I'll put it, to make us not look as silly as we were, that I've got HTTPS on podfeet.com.
Yes.
But where would I see that they're showing podfeet.com is HTTPS? Because I type it in. Sorry?
Well, how do you mean where would they? So if the person. Okay, so. If the browser arrives there and the browser is on an HTTP connection, Chrome will in future make it red, like would happen now if you went to your bank and it had an invalid cert.
Okay. But I thought
you
said
the way you get a certificate error sometimes or whatever.
Yeah, it's not showing a little lock, for example. I see a lock blink as I go by in Safari.
The chances are you're because you're sucking in content from other people, you're possibly still doing that over HTTP. So you need to go in and edit all of your little sidebar plugins to make sure they're doing everything securely, because Safari will not consider a website secure unless it's all secure.
Actually,
Firefox will give you a mixed content status.
Yeah. But I'm still not understanding where I would see it, whether it was yes or no. When you say Google, are you saying Google Chrome?
I am saying Google Chrome, yeah.
Okay, I thought you just said Google. So
I'm sorry.
You meant in search.
No, in their browser.
Okay, so Chrome, so it would show...
So right now I'm going to podfeet.com in Chrome, and right now it's going to show a neutral. It's neither red nor green, it's just neutral. And when I click on the eye, it said, your connection is not private. Details.
The page is trying to load scripts from unauthorized sources, is what it says on the right-hand side.
Yeah, so there's a few things in here. Basically, you need to add a few S's in to the various little widgets that you're sucking in.
Yeah, I'm not. Oh, wait.
We can work with it offline.
Okay, I was just curious how one would see it today versus tomorrow, so I could notice it.
Okay, well, let me see how Bart B does. So Bart B gets a padlock from Google, and it's all green. Now, if I were to have a broken cert, so if you were to set your clock into the future past my cert's validation, you would get a red sort of auga. This is insecure. So Chrome are moving to have the red insecure branding on sites that are HTTP, but that ask for passwords or credit cards.
Okay.
Not a dumb thing to do, actually. It's quite a clever thing.
Did you know that Google also... very slightly prefers HTTPS in search.
I do indeed. We talked about it in this segment.
Did we?
Basically, Google are using... It's an example of Google using their immense power for good. They also use their immense power for evil, but this is them using their immense power for good. They're basically bullying people into being secure.
Okay.
Or maybe it's a carrot, maybe it's a stick. We could argue about it. But either way, they're pushing people towards security. And this is exactly the same kind of thing. They're basically saying our browser is going to start frowning upon HTTP websites. Initially, just a few. In future, all of them. So the roadmap they've laid out is clear. HTTP, we're going to consider actively insecure. Which is good, right? Because if Google do that in Chrome, then all of a sudden, all of the little widgets are suddenly going to say, oh, okay, we better make an HTTP for HTTPS version available. I think your clock is up for the chop for the simple reason that they don't allow an HTTPS embed.
Got it.
All right. They may change their mind on that. But either way, I still want to make you a new clock as part of programming myself.
Yeah, we'll have some fun.
That'll be fun. Okay. Last story then in the important security news section. The FBI have released literally a public service announcement. So it's not a colloquial PSA. It's an actual PSA. Warning that ransomware is getting more sophisticated and asking victims in the United States to report certain information about the attack they suffer to the FBI. So they actually have a list of pieces of information they are trying to collect so they can build up a better picture of what's going on.
Oh, interesting.
So they tell you who to tell and what to tell them. And they also give you advice on how to avoid becoming a victim in the first place, so you never need to tell the FBI. and they also explain some of the things they're seeing. So what we seem to be seeing is that the attackers are not just throwing this stuff out into the wild as much anymore. Ooh. They're picking targets.
Ooh.
And they're adjusting their ransom based on how much they think you can afford.
Interesting.
Right, which makes sense. It makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
So again, that you understand the financial incentives. The FBI also advise you not to pay. So there we go.
Yeah.
Not a happy story, but it's a public service announcement.
But you know, when you do get these things, like when you get a phishing email from your bank, you really want to say, "Hey, you guys, look at this." So having a place to send it is somehow pleasing.
I agree. Yes, as I say, and it's good to see the FBI take an active interest in this because it's a serious crime. Like, it's not just something on the internet. No, it's real crime. It just happens to be on the internet.
Yeah.
Notable breaches. Oh boy, bad 2 weeks for notable breaches. 98 million with an M, plain text passwords from a 2012 breach of Rambler.ru. have now surfaced, and apparently they are being described universally in the media as Russia's Yahoo.
Oh,
I don't know if that means a has-been website. I'm not quite sure what they mean by that, but basically a very large and very popular website in Russia. So hence the 98 million, I guess. Plain text, not even a bad hash, just plain old plain text.
Oh,
looking tiny by comparison at 800,000 plain text passwords from an adult website called Brazzers. Could be highly embarrassing. I don't know how you, double Z. I'll let you pronounce it how you wish. It's not a site I frequent.
Okay. So it's only 800,000. What's it?
Only 800,000. Yeah, I mean, it's now got to the stage where that looks like a silly little number compared to the 98 million.
Yeah, why did you even bring it up? Just 800,000. Wow.
Just 800,000. Now, some of these also include more than just usernames and password. They have stuff like, I think one of them included ICQ numbers, which was cute. But they often include Facebook accounts and stuff like that. So they could be embarrassing in other ways too, as well as being plain text passwords. Again, 2.2 million plain text passwords from a service called ClickSense. Basically, these were a company that paid people to click on ads. That was their entire shtick. Now, 2.2 million have been released to prove that the attackers have something. The attackers say they have 4.4 million left to sell, if anyone would like to buy.
Oh, gosh.
So technically, it's probably 6.6 million.
Well, so these are passwords to an ad-clicking site.
Right, but I guess the thing is with password reuse, if you have an email address and a password, you can go all over the net to any website that uses email addresses and passwords and give it a go.
Yeah.
And you'll probably pick up a whole bunch of stuff.
Huh.
So, yeah. Anyway, so there we go. Notable breaches. They're all notable. And I thought it was worth updating on probably the most noteworthy breach in the last year or two, which is the breach of the Office of Personnel Management of the United States government, which involved leaking of forms people had to fill in with all sorts of icky personal details to get security clearances. And I think that 2.2 million or 98 million plain text passwords is bad, but security clearance forms is extra bad.
It's absolutely everything there is to know about a person is on a security clearance.
Yeah, because they want your full history to make sure they check you out.
Mother's maiden name.
Invasive. Invasive, yeah. So the OPM breach does still, even though it's not as big in number as what we just talked about, it is much more significant. So we talked about it a lot at the time, but I thought it was worth noting that there has been a development in that story, in the sense that the House Oversight Committee have finished their investigation of the hack and have issued their report. It is not praising of the OPM. Everyone is using words like slam and diss, and like it's harsh. It's harsh on the OPM, and with good bloody reason.
So what are they saying they did wrong?
Well, they basically didn't do security basics.
Wow.
Like, you know, it's the low-hanging fruit was hanging there low.
Wow.
So, yeah, they basically were told, you do realize it's like the 2000s. You shouldn't be dealing with stuff like it's 1980.
Wow.
I'm paraphrasing completely, obviously. But
it's
you get
so depressing.
The idea. It is a bit. Now, what might be, it's in suggested reading, but I think it's worth mentioning here because it is very much related, I think. America now has its first chief information security officer for the federal government. So this person obviously has a lot of messes to clean up, and probably top of the list for this new person will be figuring out how to make sure OPM doesn't happen again. And I don't just mean at the OPM, I mean in any other branch of the federal government. What lessons can all of us learn from that mess?
Maybe they should also be in charge of telling political people they're not allowed to have email servers at their house. Not to be political, but...
Oh, well, that's perfectly bipartisan because Colin Powell suggested it to Hillary Clinton. So,
well, he's now saying he didn't. But anyway, yeah.
FBI report says he did. It has the email where he said it.
Yeah.
So,
I don't want to argue that. But
yeah,
I
don't want to get political either. But you know,
when I look at these stories, all I can think of is where the heck was IT security? IT security doesn't let you do anything at my old company. I mean, we weren't allowed to use thumb drives. I mean, we weren't allowed to use anything. We weren't allowed to use cloud services. How on earth? I mean, this just defies my brain.
To me, it actually gets worse, right? Because you have to ask the question, why? Why did Colin Powell feel he needed his own server? And why did Hillary Clinton feel that was a good thing to emulate? And they weren't the only ones. A lot of former Secretary of States did this.
Yeah.
Why did they do this? And the answer is because the actual IT infrastructure of the State Department is so arcane and unusable that it's the only way to get your job done.
You mean archaic?
Archaic, arcane? I think they're both valid words, aren't they?
Maybe both are true.
Maybe both are true.
Yeah. Yeah. They mean different things, but they can both be true.
The system is not fit for the job it's supposed to be doing. And to me, that's as much of a scandal as anything else going on here. Why are the federal government so bad at IT? OPM, it's all obsolete stuff. That's the problem. It's State Department, obsolete. Why are we so bad? You know, why are so many governments? Because it's not just the US government. The US government do not have a monopoly on terrible state IT infrastructure. The Irish Parliament's IT infrastructure sucks every bit as much.
Yeah. In my experience, the bigger the entity, the harder it is to ever get anything done. And so stuff just languages forever. And there's a fear of messing stuff up if it affects a lot of people. So they get fearful of trying new things and saying, okay, let's move to this new thing.
I'm trying to think of the right word. Oh, it's a really good word. It's something that resists movement.
Inertia?
Inertia. Yeah, that's the one. There is so much inertia in large bureaucracies, and I think governments in particular are prone to it because public servants tend to be career people, and so the people who make it to the top have been in the public service for a very, very long time, and they're probably not very risk, they've probably become risk averse in getting to the position of power. They've probably selected them to make them so.
Self-selecting, yeah. I may have told this story before, but I worked on a project where we needed, for the grand sum of $160,000, we could move from one version of the software up to the next. It could have been done over the weekend, and it was the cost of like two little servers. And yeah. We worked on it for a long time, and I was going to do what we called ops reviews, which is where you send out you do a set of PowerPoint charts that say, what did you do? And I was looking for the template file, and I was like, oh, I'll just grab an old one. And I happened to accidentally grab one from a year before, and I didn't have to change it. Nothing.
Oh, no.
I had worked on this for a year with a dozen people. We had no change. It never got done. I retired and it never did get finished. It was $160,000 to my company is like, you know, pocket change.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So this doesn't surprise me, but it's depressing.
I see this kind of thing on a quite a regular basis. It's like, you know, big money amounts seem to get spent. No problemo. Little money amounts. Oh,
you're
oh.
Yeah.
I also noticed we skipped a story.
Uh-oh.
I was thinking I was being too easy on Google. I knew there was a trifecta of Google bad news, and we got two, and I left out the third. So Google recently updated their Play Store app, and people started complaining after the update that their battery went terrible. The update to Play seemed to affect their battery life, and it has now become clear why. The Play Store is always tracking your location, and you can't turn it off.
What? Why?
Well, you can either turn off all location services on the entire phone, or the Play Store will have location services active.
Why does the Play Store need to know where you are? Is that so you because don't download Store a UK is... thing when you're in Ireland or no. I mean, in Germany?
No, so the Google, in order to get around the problem of the fact that their OS is not under their direct control, Google have started to use the Play Store as a sort of a proxy for Google. And the Play Store actually does location on behalf of every other app. And the Play Store is where you control who gets access to your location. And so there's a slider. So if you install Twitter through the App Store, the App Store controls whether or not Twitter can have access to your location. So the App Store has become the arbiter of who gets location data. But there is a checkbox. It looks like a checkbox for the App Store itself, but it doesn't do anything. You can't click it. You can't remove its permission. So the App Store always has, and you cannot revoke, its location access unless you turn off all location services on the entire phone.
But it apparently didn't used to have it on.
Correct. Yeah. So
new
what Google
improved.
Are doing is they're moving towards this model where instead of the OS managing location services, the Play Store manages location services. And the reason is because the Play Store comes straight from Google, and the two middlemen we talked about don't get to tinker with it. So Google are pushing features into the Play Store so that they can get the features out to the phone. It's a mess, right? So we should mention that too. Suggested reading then. Some nice things, some timely things, I guess. Well, the first one isn't nice, but it's timely. then they get nicer. Brian Krebs is detailing a new technique scammer is using to trick people into helping them bypass two-factor auth. The takeaway is don't believe every text message you receive. Basically, the way this scam works is that you send someone a text message telling them that you're from Google, and that there's some problems in your account. You've spotted a fake login from China or an attempted login from China, and you're on the ball. But to prove that you are who you say you are, you're going to get a text message in a few minutes with a code. Reply to this text message with that code. So what's actually happening there is someone is trying to break into your account. They can't get in because they don't have your 2FA, and they're asking you. So they try to log into Google. Google sends you the text message, and then you forward it to them. So in other words, they're trying to trick you into passing on the two-factor auth to the attacker. So don't ever reply in a text message with the code. The code, you type it into the webpage, and that's the only thing you ever do with the code.
Right.
Never
right.
give it to anyone, no matter who they pretend to be, no matter who they say they are. So that's the advice. Okay, now the more lighthearted stuff. It's back to school time. So Intego have a blog post giving advice to securely using public computers in schools. So you're going to be on the internet on a computer that's not yours. What should you bear in mind? I think that's a good time of year for that.
Okay.
And also, Intego also took the opportunity to remind people of the 10 sort of critical security and privacy features in iOS 10. Now, they're the 10 top features in iOS 10. They weren't all new, but some of them are. So it's basically a refresher course of how things stand right now. And I would suggest you just read through the 10. Some of them you will agree with, some of them you won't. But basically what I would suggest to everyone is that you make a decision on each of those 10. So your decision may be, no, I'll keep it as it is. But do that as a decision. Think about it and then decide. Don't just stay with your defaults. So I'm not saying you must all change 10 settings. I'm saying you should all consider changing 10 settings.
Just like you say, to understand if you're making the trade-off, make it consciously, not subconscious or unconsciously. Right?
Exactly. It really is that simple.
You know, Dave Hamilton and I got into an argument on Facebook. We were talking about Touch ID passcodes, and I continue to hammer on the fact that I think people having a 4-digit passcode that people can see you put in over your shoulder and also having iCloud keychain on at the same time with your passwords is a bad idea. And he said, well, it's the same thing to get into 1Password. And I said, no, because you're going to have a long, secure password on 1Password. And he said, the vast majority of people use a very weak password for their 1Password.
Well, and I said, what evidence that would be Dropbox? Yeah.
Well, I said, what evidence of that do you have? And he said, every person I've ever helped with 1Password. And I don't help people with 1Password and let them pick a bad password. I send them to xkpasswd.net and say, pick one. I will keep hitting refresh until you like one of these. And when you like it, that's what you're going to use.
Yeah, if I'm helping someone with 1Password, a very, 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 very important part of that help is helping them pick a secure password, because otherwise what I've helped them to do is to put all of their eggs in a rickety basket.
Yeah, yeah. And Melissa Davis said she has had the same experience with, she works with a lot of older people, and she said, there's no way I could get them to use it if I made them use a really long password. Now, well, I don't know,
you probably shouldn't get them to use it, because they're then collecting all of their information in a bad, insecure place.
Yeah, I was shocked that he said that. I can't even imagine. Why would you bother? Why would you even go down that road?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Exactly. I said, here's the video of my father-in-law at 80 years old using 1Password and telling you how his fingers are all messed up and he can't type very well, and he uses a strong password, so.
Yeah, and on an iOS device, you have a finger.
Yeah.
So scan it. It's a nice way to get around it. You can still have to enter your password from time to time, but not every time.
Yeah.
And then it all becomes less evil.
Right.
Because I have a full text password on my iPhone, which sounds awful.
So do I.
Oh, my God.
So do I.
But it's not awful, because Touch ID means I type it when I boot the phone. And every couple of days, the iPhone says, actually, would you mind just proving you are who you say you are?
Yeah. Mine isn't the best password in the whole world, but you're not gonna figure it out by watching me is what I've put it on.
Precisely. And I also have, it's a text password. So it has letters, numbers, all that kind of carry on. So it's not easy to just look over my shoulder and see. And it's not hugely long, because I have my iPhone set to wipe on 10 fails.
Mm.
So if you're going to guess a many letter, and it's many more than six, if you're going to guess a many letter, relatively simple password in 10 tries,
you
good
go
luck
girl.
With that. Yeah, good luck with that. Yeah. I like to think I'm not that predictable.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, that's all I have. That's all she said. There's a few more stories in the suggested reading section, but they're bad news, so I will leave them to people's discretion.
There we go. All right, Bart. Well, thanks a lot for all the research that you do. I don't thank you often enough, and I should do that more often, because you provide a hugely valuable service to the Nocilla Castaways, and anybody who's listening here I know agrees with me and appreciates the work that you do, and it's, all for out of the goodness of your heart and nothing else. I know you don't
like
take praise.
I'd be looking this stuff up if it wasn't for the Nocilla Castaways, but I'd be annoying random people. I still remember you telling the story of how this podcast got started. I agree.
Start a podcast so that I would annoy people who cared, not people in the line of the grocery store, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that is, I mean, I'm going to be looking at the security stuff, and this way I get to tell people who care instead of random strangers.
I picture you in the shop saying, hey, have you read Krebs on Security this week?
Yeah, I wouldn't go well here.
All right, Bart, we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Talk to you in a few weeks. Until then, stay patched and stay secure.
Well, after I got off the call with Bart, I decided to try and track down what insecure scripts were running on the podfeed.com homepage that were giving the danger Will Robinson message about security. I figured it out. Guess what it was? It was the Google search box. The irony of that does not escape me. I added the S to HTTPS in the script call, and Bob's your uncle, podfeed.com, now gets a generic response from Google. Couldn't have made me happier. And let's also recall, remember I said that on the live page, the YouTube thing wasn't working until we added a yes to that? It wasn't showing up on the secure page? I'm pretty sure YouTube comes from Google, too. Now, it's important because Google is the one that is pushing everybody to go HTTPS. You would think that a YouTube live video would have an S on it if they wanted us to be doing all the security stuff. Anyway, that made me laugh. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeed.com. Follow me on Twitter at podfeed. Now remember, everything good starts with podfeed.com/. So there's podfeed.com/Patreon, podfeed.com/Facebook, podfeed.com/Google+, podfeed.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, where do you think you go? You head on over to podfeed.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.